And we'll start with the first one, the work session on 74. Do we have amendments, yes. Patrick?
Mr. Chair, attached to that staff measure summary for this, you will find the Senate Bill 74-1 amendments. They are the conflict amendments that we had drafted, Legislative Council. You'll see inside them, they basically, on the first section there in bold, it says if House Bill 2106 becomes law, then the section of Senate Bill 74, which amends Chapter 807-160, is repealed and then replaced with the language in the amendments, and it does that for this section also for 807-400. And that's just basically in the event that both of them become, both Senate Bill 2106 become law and 74 become law, then the language that's in these conflict amendments will be what goes into the statute from those in those two sections.
For both bills.
Mm-hmm. And it combines both bills, right? And it's only, and that language takes effect only if both of them are signed by the governor.
Sure. Okay. Very good. Questions? No. Comment?
Nope.
You're going to resist. Okay, I'm ready for a motion on 7104-1.
I'll do it.
Senate Bill 74.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 74 as amended. I move the -1 amendment, Senate Bill 74.
Representative Broome moves the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 74. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 74 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Broome moves Senate Bill 74 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Mike, call roll, please.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative
Meyer? Excuse.
Aye.
It was Boone.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. Excuse.
No, let me think about it. Okay, aye.
Aye.
Representative
Hunt?
Aye.
Chair Gilman?
Aye. Motion carries, and I think consent calendar. I don't think it's a big deal. Representative Broome moves that we place Senate Bill 74 on the consent calendar. Any discussion? Any objection? Okay, we'll open a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 367. Patrick?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 367A came to us from the Senate on a 23-4 vote. The bill requires drivers and passengers in privately owned commercial vehicles that are designed and used to transport 15 or fewer passengers to use safety belts. It has an exemption for taxi cab operators and places liability on passengers for failure to ensure proper use of a child safety seat system. Minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact to the bill.
Thank you. Yes, sir. Okay. Let's start. Okay, Troy, you want to come up first, please?
You did this.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales, manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Senate Bill 367 comes to you from a legislative request in relationship to an unfortunate incident in the Portland area last year with a figure skating competition, and where the mother of one of the figure skaters was in a shuttle van and ended up in a crash, and the mother was killed. And she was not wearing a belt and was discovered during that conversation in the news and the press about seatbelt laws in Oregon. That was one of a list of about a dozen exemptions from Oregon's seatbelt law. And so legislative body brought forward a request to close that loophole. a hearing was held in Hillsborough area, and a couple of different people came forward, and some of those brought up some issues that's why the bill was amended, as your committee administrator talked about, that taxi cab companies brought up the issue about wanting to be careful and not be in a spot where someone from behind them can grab a belt and get a hold of them and cause them harm. And the other big issue that was brought up during the first initial hearings was, what about children? Because in today's law, the driver is the one that would get cited if a child under the age of 16 is not properly restrained. Well, if you're in a commercial vehicle, should the driver be getting the ticket, or should the individual responsible for that minor get the ticket? And so there's the specific call out in this 367A that says it's the adult responsible and it's not the driver that gets the ticket. There are about a dozen or so exemptions to the seatbelt law, some of those from the original signature petition that we voted in 1990, and another handful that the legislative body has put into place over the past decade or so. This closes one of those loopholes. One thing I will point out is that lap belts themselves in a particular crash situation is 50% effective in reducing death or injury. A lap and shoulder belt is 67% likely to reduce death or injury, and a child safety seat is 75% effective in reducing death or injury if you're in a crash. The number of people involved in crashes for these types of vehicles are actually very few. We're talking less than 50 every year over the past decade or so, each year that have been injured in a taxi cab or shuttle van crash, and only one other time in the past dozen years or so has there been somebody killed. It's unfortunately the instance late last year where we had another one. It does strengthen Oregon's seatbelt law, and currently we are number 4 in the United States for seatbelt use in our cars, and this would help us raise that by a little bit, point or two, trying to achieve that number one goal that Representative Smith has asked me in the Ways and Means hearings. How do we get to number one for seatbelts? This is one of those ways to close a loophole. And, Mr. Chair, I'd be more than happy to answer any other questions. I know there were a couple legislators that had intended to be here, and with a guest as well, to come in and talk about the bill. I don't know if there's any other questions I could answer for you.
Thanks, Troy. Representative Burley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Troy, would you please just explain one more time? I didn't quite catch why specifically in the A and Gross version we're excluding, by saying is not required, the child safety system. I didn't quite catch why that was.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Vice Chair, it's going to require the child passenger seat, but the individual that would get the ticket is going to be the adult responsible in the vehicle, not the driver.
Got it. Thanks.
Yes, sir.
Makes sense. Further questions?
I'll ask one.
Okay, let's think that.
You were mentioning this closes one of the loopholes in the seatbelt law. So what are the loopholes that are left?
Mr. Chair and Representative Thatcher, there are exemptions to the seatbelt law for certain medical conditions, and if a doctor wants to verify that they have a medical condition where the belt would be a problem, issues with surgery in the shoulder or pacemaker or some other different things, the doctor can submit a request to my office and they get a card the person can carry with them. So if they ever are stopped, they have a card to show they have an out. If the vehicle itself was not built with belts, hope I said that right, not built with belts, and that typically is going to be pre-1967, or if it's a special vehicle built since that time but it was not initiated with belts, there are if there are more people in the vehicle than there are belts, the individuals that are in greater number do not have to wear them, and there are 6 in relationship to specific work activities, and I've called those out for you on the bottom of page 1 of my testimony, and those 6 generally came from legislative requests made by constituents, and the legislature created those 6 over the past decade or so.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Hunt, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just following up on Representative Burley's question, does it say somewhere else in statute, and Representative Burley is nodding his head, the requirement on the adult to use the child safety system? I realize this exempts the vehicle operator of this larger vehicle from responsibility, but is it already in statute that the adult is responsible, even if it's in one of these vehicles?
Ms. Chair, and Representative, can I ask if I make sure I heard you right? You're asking about the if a child is not in an approved seat, that it's the driver that's the one that's getting the citation? Where is that in statute?
Let me read.
Sorry.
Under this, the driver would not be responsible, that it would be the, based on what you just said earlier, that it would be the adult responsible for that child that is responsible. That's not in this bill. Is that already required somewhere else in statute? Because otherwise, or the way I read this language, it's saying a child that would normally be required to be in a child safety system in my vehicle, where I would be responsible, in this vehicle, if the operator of the vehicle is not responsible, who is responsible and where does it say that person is responsible?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hunt, in Section 2 of the bill, line 18, it talks about if the individual is the 16 or older is responsible for another passenger who's not in the child safety system, as prior section requiring them to be in the safety seats.
Further questions? Okay.
Okay.
Good. Thank you, Troy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
And bring your guests. Krista.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. For the record, Billy Dalto, State Representative for Oregon's 21st House District here in Salem. And I would like to introduce you to a friend of mine, Krista Whitman, who is a student at the Parish Middle School. And she's going to tell you a story about this bill. She's going to tell you a story about where this bill came from and how simultaneously, at the very same time, that the good senator from Welches was dreaming up this legislation, Krista herself dreamed up this legislation as well, and she'll tell you a little bit about it. So with that, I'll turn it over to Krista Whitman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Krista Whitman. In 1999, 11.5% of the rear seat taxi passengers involved in crashes sustained injuries such as fractures, concussions, internal injuries, bleedings, and burns. Only 17% of backseat passengers who were involved in crashes in 1999 were wearing their seatbelts. There were over 130,000 taxi and library crashes between 1990 and 1999. Shower Consulting reported all of these facts. I think that passengers in taxi cabs should have to wear their seatbelts. The reason why is because seatbelts are already in taxis. Why does any average citizen in their own transportation have to click it or ticket? $97 is how much you would have to pay if you don't click it. Why is it acceptable to lawmakers to allow citizens' lives to be risked in taxi cabs but not in citizens' cars? Are people's lives less valuable in taxi cabs than in cars? I have roughly brought with me here today 110 letters saying practically the same things I just did. Yes, I think there should be a law for wearing seatbelts. I would also like to present with you today a petition with 235 signatures from concerned citizens at Hauck Middle School who support this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify to you before today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Krista. Questions? Representative Hunt.
I'm wondering if I could just get in the advanced job offer for after you graduate from high school for my legislative assistant position.
Billy's already gone.
Actually, if I could just add a couple of things, Mr. Chair, with your permission. I made a mistake. She's actually at Hauck Middle School, not Parrish.
Yeah.
And I misstated that. But, you know, I wanted to say, I was thinking about this bill, and this is a very, very important bill. And Krista didn't go into why she brought this bill forward, and maybe we can ask her a little bit about what inspired her to bring this forward so she can get that on the record. But I wanted to say how impressed I was with Krista on this bill. Actually, why don't you go and tell them, go ahead and tell them why you brought this bill forward, and then I'll tell them why I'm impressed about why you did it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the reason why I had brought this bill forward was there was the story, the accident that happened up in Portland, and I just thought that why should any other like taxi cabs not be able to wear their seatbelts, but we have to on our own vehicle. And the story was about the skater's mother who had gotten in a taxi crash for the ice skating competition. And so I just thought that this would be, this if this became law, that it would be a very good law. And how her mother died, the ice skater's mother had died in the shuttle bus because she wasn't wearing her seatbelt. They had gotten in a car accident, and but there was a restraint there for her to use, but she didn't use it.
Okay. So, Representative Burley has a question.
Actually, I don't have a question, Chris. I just wanted to tell you that when you stopped by my office the other week to visit about this bill, I was very impressed as well, and I think you've done an outstanding job working this bill, and I really commend you for doing this.
Thank you.
And so, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say why I was impressed. As, you know, Krista read about this this problem. She was moved into action, and I think this is an example of the citizen lobbyist process at its finest. She was called to action. She tried to figure out what her options were to affect change, because she saw something that she felt that needed to be changed, and she said, well, what do I do? And so she came down to the Capitol to meet with her representative. She asked me some questions and about how the process works, and we got to sit down with Krista and a couple of lobbyists who we all had a conversation with Krista about how the legislative process works and how we move from an idea into advocacy, and how we make the an idea become a law, not just on how they show us with that one-page document of how a bill becomes a law, but actually how you make a law occur. And so we learned some important lessons about grassroots coalition building and building building other positive support about how to do that and how to research and provide documentation about why this is a problem and why we need to wear seatbelts. And one of the things that struck me most was Krista had found that the human body continues to move forward even through a crash if they're not restrained. And if they're restrained, they still move forward, but they hit the restraint and it prevents them from going forward. But you pointed out, tell them what happens when you're in the back seat and you're not restrained.
When you're in the back seat of the vehicle, it only takes 20 seconds more until you fly out of the car if you're not wearing a restraint. And so it doesn't matter if you're in the front seat or the back seat, because some people think that you're in the back seat, so the front seat's going to stop you from any flying out the window. But it only takes 20 seconds more to reach the windshield.
So important information, something I didn't know. I remember being a little kid and mom putting us in the back seat of the 79 Caprice Classic, thinking this is a big behemoth and there's a big back seat and it's not a bench seat in the front. I mean, it's a bench seat in the front, so okay, maybe I'll hit the back of the bench seat and not be propelled forward or something like that. So it was really an eye-opening experience. So I guess what I just wanted to close in is, Krista, I gave her a challenge, and the challenge was, I'm not convinced that this is a problem, but if you can convince me, then I'll sponsor the bill for you. Well, she did convince me that it was a problem, but it turns out simultaneously, just as an American team was working on the DNA strand simultaneously from Watson and Crick, the British team, people can think of good ideas, smart people think of good ideas at the same time, and that's exactly what happened here. And so, Krista, why don't you ask them to move this bill?
Mr. Chair, I would like for you guys to move this bill to the floor of the House so it will become the law.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Boone.
I apologize for being late. And Krista, I am very proud of you for doing what you've done. You've got your bill farther than some of my bills. And you did it with grace and strength and all that. And I'm very happy to support this bill. And I'll even speak to it on the floor because I think it's very, very important what you're doing.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, would you carry the bill?
I would be delighted. Oh, thank you. Yes. It was an honor, if the chair will allow it.
We'll solve that in a little bit, but I'm pretty sure she's on the inside track, okay? Any other questions or comments?
Well, I do have a comment, and I'm going to be booed out of the room here shortly, I'm sure. But, and I do. I am thoroughly impressed with you and your gumption to go through this whole entire process. And I think seatbelts are a wonderful and perfect and great idea. But on principle, I don't think it's the state's or government's job to make us do that. I think there's a lot of good ideas in life. It's just my, I'm resisting saying that the state needs to expand that. And like I say, I do still admire you, and I think reasonable people can disagree on things. And I think it's a great thing that you're doing. But I will be voting no on this committee.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming. Senator Metzger, do you want to come forward?
Well, just very briefly, Mr. Chair, I got a call. You were doing the bill today, so I will be brief.
Thank you, Chairman Gilman, members of the committee, Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. We worked this bill rather extensively in the Senate side a few months ago. And I would just say, really appreciate Krista and the testimony that she provided also in the Senate. And Representative Dalto's leadership on this issue came very, very early over on the Senate side and had expressed these issues, and appreciate their leadership on that and keeping it forward. Learning from your standpoint, Krista, about the how the legislative process works and to stay engaged in it, that is something that you just don't bring one day and just think things are going to happen. You got to stick with it. And so I appreciate the civics lesson that she's giving to all of us.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. For the comments, I just want to say that you watch this bill change a little bit, too, and that's part of this process, and it's a really good learning experience for you. It's not as good a learning experience for us. We don't like it sometimes. All right. Anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 367? I close the public hearing on 367 and open a work session on 367.
Mr. Chair. I would move that we report Senate Bill 367A in gross to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Burley moves Senate Bill 367 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Mike?
Representative Beyer?
Aye.
Representative Gilman?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
No.
Aye. Motion carries. And Representative Boone, we're assuming you're going to carry this.
I would be honored, Chair. I hope, Chris, I hope you'll come when that day comes. Come over. Watch the action. I'll try to do it justice. And I know that Representative Dalto will also be speaking in favor.
I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 445.
Patrick? Yes, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 445 modifies the definition of Class 2 all-terrain vehicles by eliminating the upper weight limit for the definition. There's an emergency clause, so the bill would take effect upon its passage and signature by the governor. No fiscal or revenue impact, and it was a 24-0 vote when it was on the Senate floor.
Thank you. That's it. And Ron Roberts.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Teddy Kaiser, and I work with Senator Joanne Berger, Senate District 5, Coastal District. I want to take this opportunity to thank you for hearing this bill. Senator Berger had wished she could come, but unfortunately she has laryngitis and won't be able to speak today. This issue came to us from the Coos County Sheriff's Office, and I thought it was best if Corporal Roberts, who works with these issues on a daily basis, explained to you the issues at hand.
Thank you. Go ahead, Ron.
Mr. Chair,
members of the committee. The reason the sheriff's office requested that this change be made to the Oregon revised statutes in reference to ATV weights was we have an increasing number of people utilizing areas in our county and across the state using all-terrain vehicles, whether it be Class 1, Class 2, or Class 3. Class 2 ATVs are vehicles that most people drive on the streets on a daily basis, be it a Jeep, a four-wheel drive, or an off-road rail. We're finding that Class 2 vehicles, which weigh more than 800 pounds, but less than 8,000 pounds, are vehicles that we buy daily. Ford F-350s, Chevy 3500 six-packs, not to mention four-wheel drive capable motorhomes. They weigh over 8,000 pounds. One of the problems that we're seeing with this is these vehicles are going into areas that are posted close to all-terrain vehicles. Well, their average thought is this is not an all-terrain vehicle. This is a pickup I drive to work. So there's no harm done. So they're going into closed areas that are close to ATVs, but they're actually driving a vehicle that will be classified as an ATV if it weighed under 8,000 pounds. They're driving into these areas. They're doing damage to the environment and also violating the law. And we found that we see these pickups in areas on the beaches and in other areas that are close to snowy plover habitat and or other, you know, vegetative reasons. These areas are close to ATVs, but they're driving 8,000-pound trucks in these areas. When we take enforcement action on them, they show the judge, well, my truck weighs 9,000 pounds. I'm not an ATV. They're correct. So there is no repercussion or way to deal with that situation.
Are these vehicles allowed where ATVs go now?
Well, Mr. Chair, committee members, yes, they are. In the Oregon Dunes, which is where I primarily work, it is legal to put an off-road vehicle tag on your pickup and a flag and drive through the dunes or on the beach in our areas. But the restriction is you know, they're a Class 2 ATV by weight and description, but if they're over that and they go into an area that's close to ATVs, no. I've seen all kinds of vehicles, different vehicles I've seen people drive, Subaru station wagons through the dunes. They put their flag and their off-road tags on. We have people who buy Ford F-350s. Same thing. Technically, because of their weight in the Ford F-350 being over 8,000 pounds, there's no requirement, or we cannot enforce the ATV tag issue and or the closure issues to them.
I understand. Other questions? I guess not.
I might make one small comment that you might find it interesting that there are vehicles you wouldn't imagine going out into the dunes, motorhomes. He was telling me about a person who had actually had a tank and was bringing it out there. Because the tank weighs more than 8,000 pounds, it exceeds our managing abilities. So, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Yeah, and I guess I'd address this question to either one of you, and I realize that what we're talking here is Coos County for these particular examples, but have we heard evidence that this is happening statewide to a degree that would merit changing the law? And the question I'm getting at is it better that we do this, or is it better that Coos County do this, and does Coos County have the purview to do this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brunn, actually, we don't have the ability to do that because you're talking about state lands, state beaches. You're talking about federal lands, Forest Service, BLM, which is also a problem in eastern Oregon. Speaking with BLM rangers in the eastern Oregon area, if I were to take my motorhome over to eastern Oregon and there's signs up off the road that says, and the, you know, basic signs like we have in our area that say no ATVs allowed, and then I take my 12,000-pound motorhome and go skirting across the sand, the desert, or the barren land, technically there's nothing they can do to me under the vehicle law. They could probably arrest me for criminal trespass. And that's one of the issues here also is there is a way to deal with this, and that's arrest people. We don't want to do that. We want to make it more of a vehicle violation than a criminal violation for criminal trespass. Instead of arresting somebody on a C misdemeanor, let's write up a smaller ticket, and hopefully they learn from that.
Mr. Chair, follow?
Sure.
Okay, so that makes sense, at least on the state lands. So what do we do about BLM and Forest Service land? And
They, well, under ORS 821-192 is a vehicle code that allows us to issue citations to people who would violate posted restrictions or posted regulations by federal agencies, state agencies, or county governments.
Okay, so you are, one more follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So are you saying if we establish these standards, the state standards for the state lands, those are, that we can make those applicable to the BLM land, even though that I guess my question is, do they ride with each other? Probably a bad analogy. Because obviously we have no jurisdiction. I don't think we have any jurisdiction over federal lands. Maybe you're telling me from a law enforcement aspect, though, that there is sort of a, there is an answer to that. I don't know if I'm making my question clear. I'm just wondering how we can affect one and how do we affect the other.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brunt, actually, as a law enforcement standpoint, yes, we do. But state laws apply to federal land. If you go out and kill somebody on federal land, you still violate state law and or federal law too, but same with vehicle codes. Their laws mimic state laws in reality, and they have codes or certain little vehicle codes that allow them to issue a citation. Let's say somebody's suspended in Oregon. They operate a vehicle on federal land. Well, they have a little code that they write up and give them a federal citation. We have the authority, the dunes, for instance. You can't operate your vehicle on the Oregon dunes after midnight and between 6:30 or 6 o'clock in the morning in certain areas. If you're caught doing that, it is a federal violation or federal, it's a federal law, and it's a violation of their code. But we also have a vehicle statute that allows us to write that citation also. Okay. So, yes, it mimics and it helps us, and it also helps them.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Yeah, and I have a feeling maybe you've kind of answered my question in there somewhere. I'm just trying to make it a little clearer in my mind. And I looked at this and I thought, now why wouldn't you just say post signs saying no motorized vehicles allowed as opposed to reclassifying something? And it has to do with the ATV laws are stricter than, is it the, than a trespassing law, or... Can you clarify it for me?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, I think one of the issues is yeah, there are some issues there. There's standardized signs that all different agencies use, whether it be state, Forest Service, or BLM. Some areas are open to regular motor vehicles, but they're closed to ATVs. Some areas are open just to ATVs or certain weight size ATVs. We have trails in our county. There's trails in Tillamook County that are defined as class 3 trails, which is motorcycles. So it's easier to just change the weight limit than try and change the sign statewide. One, I think, would be that'd be the easiest way to say it. And if you just put up no motorized vehicles, somebody's still going to push that issue there. You have a weight limit on and different descriptions for all three ATVs. The weight difference doesn't make it. You can still take them there. You just have to follow the same rules as the ATVs.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions?
Yes. Okay, I'm still having a hard time grasping what you're getting. I apologize. You want to remove the upper weight limit for Class 2 all-terrain vehicles, meaning now they don't have to be 8,000 pounds or under. They can be above that. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, yes. Basically what it means is they're taking out the other, the upper limit is most trucks, most cars, most vehicles weigh between 800 pounds and 8,000 pounds. But nowadays you're seeing the Ford F-350 six-pack, which is a one-ton vehicle, dry weight, which means sitting on the lot, no fuel in it, no nothing, weighs 7,100 pounds. You put fuel in it, weight in it, and you're up over 8,000 pounds. Where you go to an area where it says no ATVs allowed, He can legally drive in there, but yet he is, because he's not classified as an all-terrain vehicle now because he's over the 8,000-pound weight limit.
Thank you. I understand now. Thank you.
May I correct you a little bit? He really can't
legally drive in there because there may be a trespass
right.
situation. But the vehicle code would say he can't legally go in there if we change this. Is this the right interpretation?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Basically, vehicle code-wise, he would not be able to if you change it. The way it is now, basically, we'd have to be arresting people and charging right. them with C misdemeanors for trespassing.
Yeah.
And we don't want to do that.
I'm getting up slowly. Okay. Anyone else to testify on 445? Public hearing and open the work session on Senate Bill 445.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 445 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Burley moves Senate Bill 445 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Michael?
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative
Byer?
Aye.
Chair Gilman?
Aye. Motion carries. And I think we can put it on the consent calendar.
Yep.
Representative Hurley moves we place 445 on the consent calendar. Any discussion? Any opposition? Motion carries. You don't like my imaginary motions that come out of there?
No, that's fine. That was a great one. I wouldn't want to explain it on the floor.
Exactly.
Okay. I'll open a public hearing on 448. Patrick?
Mr. Chair, member, Senate Bill 448A exempts from the motor carrier laws vehicles that are used for public transportation purposes approved by a district school board, vehicles used in the transportation of persons for hire by nonprofit entities, regardless of the distance traveled, and government vehicles owned or operated as carriers of persons for hire. There's an emergency clause in this bill, so it will become effective upon passing its signature by the governor. No fiscal or revenue impact, and Senate vote was 25-1.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, by your leave, can I bring my able colleague up?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Welcome, Martin. All right, Senator.
Thank you, sir.
What are we doing here?
You're passing a fine piece of public policy. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state senator from District 16, and I am here before you today to help you rectify a difficult situation that exists all over Oregon. There is a lack of clarity between the emerging reality of passenger transportation and the regulations governing passenger transportation. A series of complaints and findings of lack of compliance have come forward based on, I think, a generalized misunderstanding of what laws apply to passengers. And Martin will describe this in greater detail, but I think many of you would find in your own districts, and what brought this to a head in many cases was the withdrawal of Greyhound and Trailways out of small communities. I think many of you will find in your own districts that your councils of governments or counties are operating perhaps not in complete compliance with the law. And we are bringing you a bill that, as you heard, passed out of the Senate with big numbers that will try to rectify this situation. And having made that opening statement, I'll turn over all the hard questions to Martin.
Thank you. Chair Gilman, committee members, my name is Martin Loring. I work for the Oregon Department of Transportation as administrator of its public transit division. Senator Johnson is correct. This bill did grow out of a complaint received last summer by ODOT's Motor Carrier Transportation Division. And as part of the fact-finding, enforcement action had to be taken, and upon reflection, the actions didn't seem to represent good public policy, but they were the law. And this bill would, in effect, reduce regulation to correct those problems. It's easiest to describe what is involved by the examples that were presented. The city of Astoria, I guess it's the Chamber of Commerce, has an annual crab and seafood festival. Lots of people flocked to that town to take part. The chamber contracted with the transportation district to try to help move people around in that community. They didn't have enough vehicles. It was summertime. They worked out a deal with the school district to use the buses. Now, this sort of activity is explicitly allowed in the ORS 327 statute that governs school buses. But in the motor carrier statute, school districts are exempt from motor carrier regulation if and only if they're transporting their own students. So technically, the school district should have had authority or something like that. Again, it may not have made sense, but it was the law. As part of that complaint, the Tillamook Transportation District was issued a cease and desist order for delivering the daily round-trip transportation service between Tillamook and the city of Portland that the voters that created that district wanted delivered. That action was stayed pending the result of action on this bill that Senator Johnson and her predecessor, Senator Dukes, caused to be drafted to try to correct that problem. And the third circumstance that got caught up in this is that under current motor carrier statute, not-for-profit corporations are exempt from motor carrier regulation, but only if they're operating within 40 miles of their point of origin. I'm sure there's a good reason that was written into the statute, but now we have circumstances, say Christmas Valley in Lake County, where the senior center maybe once a week loads up a vehicle and takes it over the hill 100 miles to St. Charles Medical Center in Bend. That's more than 40 miles. Technically, they need regular route authority from Motor Carrier Transportation Division. We don't think that requirement serves the public interest, and Senator Johnson has drafted a bill to expand the exemption to eliminate that requirement, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about it.
I would just amplify what Martin said. For many community events, and this one in Astoria brings 30,000 people to a town of 10,000. It's a very complex festival. Being able to tap into the unused asset of school buses that are sitting idle is a godsend to move these people around in a community. And I think it's the other example that Martin gave that's particularly compelling is to try to arrange for medical visits. And we just simply can't do it. And this will bring great clarity to Martin's shop, and it will resolve the situation where suddenly you have a rural transportation program, as in Representative Boone and my district, faced with a cease and desist order, and that eliminates the only available transportation for those folks. So this really is a good policy for rural communities, utilizes underutilized assets, and we think that it will make life much easier for the motor carrier folks and certainly for the public transit folks. So we bring you this bill, and again, remind you that it came out of the Senate with one dissenting vote.
Questions, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree, it's good public policy. Just out of morbid curiosity, though, can you explain that one dissenting vote? Any idea, or was there no explanation?
I would be happy to explain it, Mr. Chair and Representative Bruin. It is my colleague and good friend, Senator Schrader, who has a lengthy and distinguished record of voting no on lots of bills that he thinks are not absolutely necessary for the public health, safety, and benefit. He has a distinguished record in this regard. It should not be, I think, seen as a reflection on the policy here, but more as a reflection of Senator Schrader's penchant to vote no.
There you have it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm not quite, and I certainly don't have any problem with this bill. In fact, I'm thinking actually down the road, even in Bend, we're looking at the possibility of trying to combine these different fleets that we have now so that, you know, instead of having Mount Bachelor buses and school buses and Dial-A-Ride and whatever else comes in, we've got one fleet of vehicles that are serving the community for all these different purposes. And if I understand this, I mean, this actually is going to be one step in helping clear some of these obstacles to achieve that.
Chair Gilman, Representative Burley, yes, that is exactly so.
So, but just for my morbid curiosity, I don't quite understand. If 332.427 exempts school buses specifically from motor carrier regulation, Is that correct?
Chair Gilman, Representative Burley, the 332-427 doesn't deal with motor carrier authority. We have Greg Galpani here, the administrator of the Motor Carrier Transportation Division. If we get into the technical stuff, he's your man. He's the expert. But my understanding of that statute, it says that school buses may use their vehicles to do more than transport their own pupils under certain circumstances.
Okay. I think my question's more than a misunderstanding of what you said earlier. I thought you had said that school buses are already exempt from motor carrier regulations.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Greg Galpani, Administrator for the Motor Carrier Division. Mr. Chairman, Representative Burley, the statute that appears to enable the use of the school buses is actually in conflict with another statute in Chapter 825, Chapter 825.017, Paragraph 1, specifies the exemption that allows school buses to be used without operating authority, but limits that exception to only when they are transporting students or students and parents. And so this concept in Senate Bill 448 eliminates that apparent conflict.
Yeah. Well, now you've really got me confused. Paragraph 1 exempts vehicles used by or under contract with a school district when they're transporting students or whatever associated with school activity. That exemption refers to the motor carrier regulations.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burley, yes, and in particular it's referring to the economic regulation requirements, which means they have to have authority.
I got it. Okay, so by adding or for purposes provided under 332-427, that's where we pick up now the availability to use them for other public transit.
Exactly.
Type. Okay, I got it. Thank you. And then I also just want to note, again, just to make sure I'm understanding this, on page 2, lines 27 and 28, by deleting that subparagraph D is where we're getting to the nonprofit question.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Byer.
Okay, silly one, but what we're regulating is the vehicle itself, the driver, or both?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Byer, in this context, we're talking about economic regulation, which is regulating entry, getting into the business, routes, and rates.
Other questions?
I don't think so.
Mr. Chair, thank you for doing this very much. I was late to committee today because I was on the phone with Heather Ornelas from the Tillamook Transportation District, returning a call that I had received yesterday, actually, but I wasn't here. So, and she's very supportive, obviously. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank Martin, you. When we get through, I'll have a question for you, but I don't want to muddy the water.
Thanks, Fred. Right.
Okay, well. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 448 and open a work session on Senate Bill 448.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 448A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Hunt moves Senate Bill 448 to the House floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Michael?
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Chair Gilman?
Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to move, given the fact that the lone dissenting vote was Senator Becker.
Schrader.
Thank you.
Schrader.
Just testing. that we put this on a consent agenda.
Perfect. Representative Burley moves we place whatever the number is, 448 on consent agenda. Any discussion?
Any opposition? So ordered. Perfect.
Mr. Chair. Yes. I move that we suspend the rules and allow Representatives Boone and Beyer to vote on Senate Bill 74.
Okay. I think we closed it, but I'll close it. And now open a work session.
Senate Bill 74.
And Representative Thatcher moves that we suspend the rules and allow Representative Boone and Beyer to vote on 74. Any objection? Seeing none, Representative Boone, how do you vote?
Aye.
Thank you. And then Representative Beyer?
Aye.
Doesn't change the outcome. Thank you for your votes. Okay, anything else? You know, I think we should start. You're absolutely right, Representative Hunt. We'll start later and later. We'll get through earlier and earlier. No meeting on Friday.
Oh.
And on Monday, we'll look at wonderful 2608 again.
Oh, yeah. I propose we start that hearing at 3 o'clock.
A.M.
If there's nothing else, close the meeting.
Always finding out something.